Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with growing awareness that Donald Trump is dangerously unqualified to be president and that he is neither stable nor competent, as Republican Senator Bob Corker suggested. Yet he is wildly popular with 80% of the Republican voters. Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, joins us to discuss the tribal division in America between those inside government who have dealt with this deluded and possibly deranged individual in the Oval Office and the 65% of Americans who are beginning to understand the deeply embarrassing and frightening nature of this electoral aberration. While on the other side, 35% of the country are happy with the economy and love what Trump is doing, trashing the press and praising the Confederacy. And now since Stephen Bannon has his hands back on his Breitbart weapons, we can expect the country to be further polarized by right-wing radicals who see themselves at war with the Marxist liberal establishment, globalists, and cosmopolitans. Then, with Trump ignoring the 40,000 overwhelmingly peaceful marchers in Boston yesterday protesting a gathering of about 100 neo-Nazis, as he tweeted out, "looks like many anti-police agitators in Boston," we will examine the role of the remaining white supremacists and fascist sympathizers in the White House, Sebastian Gorka and his wife, Catherine, who apparently influences Trump's thinking and have managed to curtail Homeland Security's efforts to monitor white supremacist domestic terrorists in the country. David Shanza, professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke University, joins us to discuss the Trump administration's willful blindness towards who is responsible by far for most of the domestic terrorism in America. Then finally, we look into the use of vehicles as instruments of terrorism, both in Charlottesville and Barcelona, and speak with Mia Bloom, an expert on terrorism at Georgia State University and the author of Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror, and the forthcoming Small Arms, Children and Terror. She joins us to discuss the teenage terrorist involved in the Barcelona massacre and the different approach Spanish authorities take towards their Muslim communities, as opposed to the Trump administration's demonization of whole communities who now no longer feel they can cooperate with local police. And joining us now is Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she focuses on issues of rule of law, security, and governance. She was the founding president of the Truman National Security Project and named one of the top 40 under 40 political leaders by Time magazine, and was appointed to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the United States Department of State, and is the author of Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld.
Thank you.
And many commentators are suggesting that the strange behavior of Donald Trump in the foyer of Trump Tower last Tuesday really revealed who Donald Trump is in private and in White House meetings, and that the few adults in the room have to spend their time trying to disabuse Donald Trump of these strange ideas he gets from Fox News, from Breitbart, and from Alex Jones. And furthermore, they're suggesting that this moment could be compared to the Access Hollywood tape moment back during the campaign when the true nature of Donald Trump's attitudes toward women was revealed. But of course, the lesson there is that he survived Access Hollywood. So do you think he's going to survive this current kind of awakening going on as to who this man really is in the Oval Office?
Well, I think we've got a couple of questions there wrapped into one, Ian. One question is, will he survive in terms of getting anything through Congress? And there, I think the answer is no. I think Congress has really woken up to the true nature of this person. I don't know why it took them so long, but I think power obscured a lot of Republicans' views of him, and now it's become clear that he has no loyalty. So, and that he's not a capable, sane man. And so I think within Congress, you're going to start seeing a huge break very quickly, and you're already seeing that. Within the idea of him getting impeached or being forced out of office, That's a trickier thing, and there you have to do the math, and I don't see the math working right now. I'm not sure if this is the moment where that might happen. And then the third question is whether the American people start turning against him. And here, I think we've got a real issue. You've got a lot of the American people, of course, who were never for him. You have a subset who voted for him for other reasons. You know, they were hoping to get a Supreme Court justice, which they got, or they were hoping that he would advance a more regular conservative Republican agenda, which they're probably not going to get. But then you have a hardcore of people who have been waiting to hear this sort of thing for a long time. Maybe they've never voted before. Maybe they've always felt this way. And finally, they have someone speaking for them. And the more he is unleashed, the more that tribal identity, I think, comes out. And the way that the left has been going about saying that this man is unhinged doesn't help, because then those people see us as attacking them. So I think you won't see much of his agenda getting through. I also don't think you'll see him impeached. And I think the longer he's in office, the more that group of about 35% of the voting public of America, which of course is not 35% of America as a whole, doubles down and sticks with him.
And is this likely to be exacerbated now that Stephen Bannon has left the White House and it's just now he's got his hands back on his weapons at Breitbart and he's ready to go to war? And I must say, this notion of war is used quite a lot by the radical right in this country, who really do believe that there is a kind of Marxist liberal establishment of globalists and cosmopolitans.
Well, not just by the radical right. Of course, you've probably seen the NRA's latest fundraising videos, which also bring up these ideas of culture wars, but they walk very quickly to turning a culture war into a law and order war and then into something that you approach with arms. Yeah, I think that it's worrisome that Breitbart is now going to be reinvigorated by Bannon. Now, whether Bannon is friendly with Trump or angry with Trump or pushes further than Trump, it's hard to know. I was just crunching the numbers, actually. I was just looking at the data on the Republican Party. And one thing that you see when you look at that data on voting behavior is that the base of the party is actually far more radical than the party itself. So you have this base that's just running to the far right, and the party just can't keep up. So as much as the party seems to be moving right, which they are, if you measure, there's a database called DW Nominate that looks at scores of how conservative members are voting. They're moving, the Republican Party is definitely moving to the right based on those scores, but their base is outrunning them. And it's because of things like Breitbart and Fox that are pulling further and further to the right. And it's hard to know how much further we can go and remain a democracy.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she focuses on issues of rule of law, security and governance. She was the founding president of the Truman National Security Project and named one of the top 40 under 40 political leaders by Time magazine, and was appointed to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the United States Department of State, and is the author of Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. Well, not only is Stephen Bannon promising to inflame the divisions already in this country, and much of the commentary going on since this Charlottesville tragedy has been a criticism of our president, who is not a uniter but a divider, and the point's been made many times that other presidents, previous presidents at a time of tragedy, have tried to heal the nation, whereas Donald Trump seems to be throwing fires on the flames of division. But he will do so even more, I believe, this coming Tuesday in Arizona, where he's down there possibly to pardon Sheriff Joe Arpaio and certainly to hurt the re-election chances of fellow Republican Senator Jeff Flake.
You're absolutely right, and I think Jeff Flake is a great example. I mean, I'm a Democrat, and I'm not a fan of Jeff Flake. He's an extreme conservative. He sees himself as the heir to Barry Goldwater. But he's a conservative who believes in the principles of conservatism, and I can respect that. And he's come out, as you know, with this book saying that not only has Trump taken over his party in this sort of hostile takeover, but the party has allowed him to do it. So that has meant it's not nearly as hostile, and that the party has given up its conservatism for power. And so I think we're starting to see what happens when one party does that. And it's, I study democracy all around the world, and I think what we're moving toward is something quite dangerous. Democracies do fall apart. You do see them. We've seen it a number of times in Latin America. We're seeing it now in Poland and Hungary. Philippines. You can see democracies vote people in who reduce the worth of the institutions and reduce the friendliness between the people, so that people so dislike one another that it's impossible to do anything that brings the nation together. And then the country can really devolve into violence and into poverty and things like that. And we might be headed for that.
So is there, I find it pretty conspicuous, for example, that the religious right is certainly not coming out to condemn Trump, and I find it extraordinary that the leader of the Jewish state of Israel, Netanyahu, has not really had any kind of full-throated criticism of Trump's making excuses for neo-Nazis. Is that debate simply gone into this polarization, this tribalism? I mean, a part of me thinks that one of the reasons why so many of Trump's supporters, as you see them now being polled and being asked on television about their continuing support for Trump, and at the Iowa State Fair, they're all, praising Trump. Is it a part of it, the reason that they make excuses for Trump's peculiar dalliance with the white supremacist, is this notion of equal time that we have in our media, that in the universe of discourse is two equal and opposite opinions always, and therefore Trump is all he's saying to them, it's there's a problem on both sides, there's violence on both sides. Is that what informs that that lack of proportionality in the at least that big chunk of the American public that supports Trump?
So I think two things are going on here, and they're interlinked, but they're separable, and it's important to separate them. One is that the left and the right of America are polarized to a degree that they haven't been since the 1890s. So the last time we saw this level of separation between the left and right was the 1890s, and we can talk about how that got healed, but it wasn't pretty. The other thing that's going on is a polarization between the elites and the non-elites. And that is something that both parties are guilty of. Both parties have been pushing economic policies that help the rich get richer. Both parties have been helping and listening to people of the upper middle class rather than the people on the bottom. The Democrats tend to listen to the people on the very bottom and at the top, and the Republicans tend to listen to people at the top and near the top. But your kind of working class, lower class folks have not gotten heard for a long time, and they're angry. And they've been angry really since Reagan. They had hope under him for a while, and then it started to dissipate under a more status quo Republican Party. So you put those two things together, and you have a group of people who have leaned right for a long time, but who haven't been listened to by the right, who now feel that they've got a full-throated supporter in the White House, and they're reveling in finally having someone who feels the things that they feel and who will voice things that they'll voice. And it has as much to do with class, but by which I mean what they watch, what they listen to, not by how much money they have, but a whole series of identity markers, as it does with left and right. But those two things play into each other. And so you've had a right-wing radio and media world that for a long time has said that the left-wing media can't be trusted. And these folks have listened to that for a long time, and now they've put that together with Trump, and they've kind of reaped what they've sowed.
Well, when you refer to the 1890s, of course, the previous Gilded Age, and many suggest that we are in another Gilded Age, and we certainly do have money-driven politics. And I believe during the McKinley versus William Jennings Bryan's race, the Republicans outspent the Democrats something like 80-1. But of course, back then, William Jennings Bryan was a member of what you could call the religious left. But now we have a religious right dominating Republican politics. And given the money-driven nature of our politics, it does seem that you've got, it's the right-wing plutocrats like Mercer and Koch. The Koch brothers clearly have a lot of influence over the Congress and of getting their way with what little the Congress has achieved. And the Mercers seem to have tremendous influence over Trump. He just, Mercer met with Stephen Bannon on Wednesday last week for several hours, and then on Thursday had dinner with Donald Trump. So we don't really know the true nature of Bannon's exit and what their plans are. And, of course, Mercer's going to put up a lot of money to defeat Jeff Flake. So are we in a situation where you have basically their plutocrats versus our plutocrats?
In certain ways, and I think that's why I think the 1890s comparison is so important and why the inequality issues play so much into today's world, because the Republican, any party, any political party controls its message and its messengers through controlling get out the vote, through controlling money, through controlling media, and through controlling data. And the Republican Party basically outsourced all of those things. So they have a media machine that they don't really control. These plutocrats on the Republican side both fund candidates to a very strong extent, but also after Citizens United, they fund super PACs and so on that have far more money than the party. Koch and a number of the other leading Republican donors have get-out-the-vote efforts themselves, and they can work with the evangelical churches, which also have get-out-the-vote efforts. So what you see on the Republican side is a party that actually has very little control over its message or messengers, and these major, major money donors who have a lot more control. And those individuals want certain things. Now, I don't know the top people personally, I must say, on the Republican side. I know what I've heard about them, but I don't know them personally, so I can't speak to what they want. But I can speak to the amount of fear they've spread through the right. I just spent all last week actually meeting with Republicans and conservatives who were never Trumpers of one sort or another, and they are terrified by the amount of money, because that money basically means that if they speak out loudly, they lose their jobs. They lose their ability to keep working in conservative think tanks. They lose their ability to keep working for conservative members of the Hill. They have to find new careers at mid-career. And so that money is silencing a lot of people on the right who don't like this man, but have kids in college or have other things that they're thinking about and can't afford to lose their jobs.
So do you think, though, that on the Democratic side there's too much sort of wishful thinking about impeachment and that rather than come up with a new narrative and new candidates and a movement, which is, I think, is inchoate and out there. After all, the day after Trump's inauguration, millions of women showed up to vote. And by the way, 40,000 people marched yesterday in Boston, and there were like about 100 neo-Nazis cowering in a rotunda. So the numbers are out there. So my sense is that there's a huge problem here with the Democrats getting their act together, because too many are relying on this idea that this guy's going to get impeached or he's going to quit in a huff.
Well, I agree with you, and I actually think that the Democrats, in a way, have just as big a problem as the Republicans, but it's harder to deal with. The Republican Party has imploded. It's been subject to this semi-hostile, semi-accepted takeover. And so the real conservatives are trying desperately to take back their party. But I think the more Trump unmasks himself, the easier that will be. On the Democratic side, because everything Trump does plays to Democrats getting more people out, they think they can be a little more sanguine. But the reality is, everybody is going to be running for president in 3.5 years. You're going to see any Democrat coming out of the woodwork to run. That could actually be a problem. It could be hard to unite behind someone. And if you look at the numbers on the Democrats, I was looking at both sides when I was crunching those numbers, Democrats are also to the left of their party more and more. So in 95, I believe it was, about 27% of Democrats identified as liberal. Now it's 41%. So it's still not the majority, but you're getting more and more Democrats saying, we're on the Elizabeth Warren progressive wing. And that is not necessarily what would win in a general election, but it's where the energy is in the party. So both parties have trouble, and I think both parties need to remake messages that were basically left over from the 20th century. I mean, this was, both parties existed in a world in which Russia was the bad guy, in which America was on top. We were the major power in the world. We could set the tone in the world. After the last three presidents, and I do think all three of them played a role in this, we can't do that anymore. And we're in a different world. And the parties need to recognize that and need to be able to address both the technological changes and the global changes that are causing economic issues here at home and issues of pride and power here at home to change. Democrats are not doing that very well. I don't think they're, what was it called, the New Deal? The better deal. I can't remember the adjective. But, you know, the fact that I don't know it when I'm part of that, you know, pretty deeply part of that party is a problem.
Well, Dr. Rensch Kleinfeld, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she focuses on issues of rule of law, security, and governance. She was the founding president of the Truman National Security Project and named one of the top 40 under 40 political leaders by Time magazine, and was appointed to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the United States Department of State, and is the author of Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the Trump administration's willful blindness towards white supremacists responsible for most of the domestic terrorism in America.